Actu SF, les podcasts.
Bonjour à tous. Bonjour le Festival des Utopiales, qui est ravi d'accueillir ici John Scalzi pour la seconde fois. Donc, je vais vous raconter un petit peu l'histoire de la vie de John Scalzi, et qui me corrigera, et après je irai corriger Wikipédia. Donc, si j'en crois Wikipédia, vous êtes né le 10 mai 1969 à Fairfield, en Californie, où vous avez grandi. Après le lycée, le Webb School of California, vous entrez à l'Université de Chicago en philosophie et en creative writing. Et vous participez notamment au journal étudiant de Chicago Maroon. En 1991, vous commencez à rédiger des critiques de films pour le quotidien The Fresno Bee. C'est d'ailleurs là que vous rencontrez votre future épouse. De 1996 à 1998, vous travaillez pour American Online. Et en 1998, vous vous lancez en écrivain freelance et débutez votre blog Whatever, qui vous vaudra un prix Hugo 10 ans plus tard. Et qui célèbre aujourd'hui son 20e anniversaire. La même année naît votre fille Athéna, autrice, il me semble d'une des photos qui devrait passer sur scène bientôt. Et en 2001, vous emménagez à Bradford, une petite ville de l'Ohio où vous habitez toujours. Votre premier roman, Agent to the Stars, un impresario du troisième type, fut publié d'abord online, puis racheté par Tor Books. Mais celui qui vous fait décoller, Le vieil homme et la guerre, est publié directement en 2009 et nommé l'année suivante pour le prix Hugo du meilleur roman. Il est à bête, non?
Non.
Ah.
Published in 2005, it was nominated, but did not win. Spin won that year.
Ça n'a pas gagné, pardon. Oui, c'est ce qui a été. Alors, il est habituellement comparé avec Starship Trooper et La guerre éternelle de Joel Deman, au point que vous y faisiez un clin d'œil dans The Ghost Brigade. À cette comparaison, un clin d'œil assez amusant. C'est parce que ça vous plaisait, cette comparaison, ou parce que ça vous agaçait au final, parce que c'était fréquent?
No, I liked it very much. I mean, Heinlein is somebody that I grew up with, so the fact that someone was said, this is just like Heinlein, was really wonderful for making a first impression. So that was okay with me.
Oui, effectivement. En 2010, vous êtes élu président de la Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, organisation littéraire qui décerne chaque année le prix Nebula. Votre roman Red Shirts, au mépris du danger, a obtenu le prix Hugo du meilleur roman 2013 et le prix Locus du meilleur roman de science-fiction 2013 aussi. Vous avez été engagé en 2009 comme consultant de la série télévisée Stargate Universe. The Collapsing Empire, premier tome d'une série prévue pour au moins 2 livres, est sorti en anglais en mars 2017 et a obtenu le prix Locus du meilleur roman de science-fiction. Yeah. Et c'est donc votre seconde apparition aux Utopiales. C'était quand la première?
I believe it was 2009, although it might have been 2010. I can't remember. But I remember actually having a very good time, so it was very nice to be back.
Ça a beaucoup changé?
It's bigger! It's a lot bigger, but and in terms of what you're doing for events and stuff, it's similar, and it's very interesting because it's quite a bit different than the conventions and festivals in the United States. There, it's much more commerce oriented as opposed to here, where you're talking about ideas a little bit more. So, I think that's to your advantage rather than ours. So, well done.
Alors, nous fêtons cette année les 200 ans de Frankenstein, que Brian Aldiss, entre autres, tenait pour le premier vrai roman de science-fiction. Il n'était pas le seul. Au point qu'Aldiss en réécrivit sa propre version, et il ne fut pas le seul. Vous-même, dans le cycle du vieil homme et la guerre, vous réappropriez le concept de Frankenstein avec les soldats de la flotte fantôme. Ces humains nés adultes, créés à partir d'un cocktail d'ADN récolté sur le corps de gens morts, avant d'avoir été transformé et intégré à la flotte normale, mais de façon, comment dire, secrète, pratiquement. Alors, comme dans Frankenstein, les soldats à la flotte fantôme représenteraient un changement de paradigme dans la production des soldats, une industrialisation libérale de la production de corps destinés à la boucherie contre les aliens, selon vous?
Oh, I mean, I think that absolutely. I mean, the ideas that Frankenstein presented, among many other things, is what does the creator owe to the created? Do they, you know, how do they approach and deal with their humanity? And that is something that is not resolved very satisfactorily for either the creator or the created in Frankenstein. I mean, there was a huge tension there. And so when I was thinking about it with the Ghost Brigades in particular, where we're talking about the special forces who are basically grown in a lab, have a lifetime of memories basically forced into them very early, and they function as adults, but they are essentially children. The question of what they are owed by the Colonial Defense Forces is a very real one. And it's something that the Colonial Defense Forces is very aware of itself. One of the reasons that there are so few Special Forces is that they know that if there were too many of them, they would be overwhelmed. That they would simply, because they would start thinking, well, what, you know, what do we owe them? What do they owe us? And they would just decide not to participate anymore. So that's why they're kept highly select, highly controlled, and are used for only the worst cases in terms of battle and so on and so forth. So it is very much in the consciousness of both the people who created the special forces and the special forces themselves that they are in fact Frankenstein's monsters. They are not quite human in the way that we are traditionally thinking of humans. And part of their journey is dealing with that and the fact that they are bred for and they're created for and on an industrial scale for warfare.
Et justement, ces soldats si jeunes dans un corps d'humain adulte se montrent d'une humanité troublante, voire bouleversante. Leur éthique est forgée par la programmation de leur ami cerveau et se trouve parfois bien plus solide que celle des vrais nés. Ce qui se rapproche terriblement, effectivement, du monstre Frankenstein lui-même, qui commence par aider les Lassay, la famille Lassay, naturellement parce qu'il voit qu'ils sont en train de mourir de faim, avant d'être rejetés par eux lorsqu'ils s'aperçoivent par qui ils sont aidés. Frankenstein, avant d'être blessé profondément par les humains, est une sorte de bon sauvage, entre guillemets, que la société va rendre monstrueux au-delà de sa forme. Alors, ça revient à cette innocence fondamentale des soldats de la Brigade Fantôme, mais est-ce qu'elle nous dit quelque chose en creux sur votre conception de l'éducation, des valeurs attachées au concept d'humanité, et quelles sont ces valeurs, selon vous?
Well, one of the things that, I mean, I do think about humans and our place in the world and in society. That's obvious, I think, anyone who reads the writing. And a lot of my conception of what we owe to each other and what we owe to our society goes back to high school. I went to a high school called the Webb School of California. Wikipedia was right about that. And one of the classes that we had was a class that was called Individual Humanities. And the idea of individual humanities through... We looked through some of the classics of Western literature, and the idea was the goal of society was the creation of individuals, but that the individuals would then see as their highest life crisis, their mission, their goal, service to the community. And so the idea is that we all develop as humans. We all are individuals. We all have our unique skills. But if we do not see as part of our crisis, being part of our community and helping our community and helping those other individuals in our community, then we have failed in some way or another. Now, this is in many ways a very classical, in some ways possibly even conservative way of looking at the world, but I do think it is absolutely true. I mean, all of us are unique. All of us are individuals. It's right down to our DNA. We are all separate people, and we should be developing into the best people that we can be with our talents, with our abilities. But ultimately, we all live in a society. We all live in our communities, both large and small. And if our only thought of these communities are what we can take out of them rather than what we can put into them, then we have failed. So that is an overarching ethos that I think is visible in the Old Man's War series and in other books that I have written as well.
Ça n'est pas tellement conservateur finalement comme vision, le collectif, l'individu avant le collectif, enfin après le collectif justement, et l'individu au service du collectif.
Well, yeah, I suppose I would say it's conservative in the sense of that we all belong to a community. I don't think these are new concepts. I don't think that they are. Perhaps conservative is not the right word. Perhaps the right word is old. You know, the idea that we are all, you know, that we are all just we are all part of a community and a collective, but that each of us has the opportunity in our own way to contribute and to make the community a better place. And how that happens, it depends on the individual, and it is one of those things that's very frustrating to me as a person and as a political being, that so much of politics these days, in America particularly, but I think everywhere, has started to be less about the community and more about what can I get out of it before it all falls apart. And then that's actually part of the theme of the newest books that are out in English, which haven't come out in France yet, the Interdependency series, where there is an ecological collapse that is happening. And there are people like, we know it's coming, we know it's probably going to happen, but in the meantime, we have an opportunity to, you know, scrape up as much as we can for each other, you know, for ourselves, and let other people worry about it later. And so that's, you know, that's something that I think about, and it's something that's very disheartening to me. I think that we need to refocus on the idea that we are all in this together and that this is a finite planet.
Vous croyez qu'il y aura un sursaut collectif pour collectivement éviter le désastre?
I certainly hope so. The thing about humans, we are amazing creatures and we can do lots of things that are miraculous, but we will wait until the very last possible moment to do it. Part of it is just inertia. It's easier not to have to do things. But part of it is also we have to get our backs up to the wall to get to the moment where we decide that we need to change. The wall is just inches away from us right now. I mean, we've been seeing the climate reports that say, in fact, you know, we have a decade or so before it's sort of an irreversible ecological change is happening. And I think that we're probably going to miss that goal, but then what happens after that will be the interesting thing. I am essentially, ultimately, an optimist about humans. I do think we will pull our heads out of our posteriors, but it will take until the absolute latest moment. And I can certainly understand that. I mean, you know, we are a group of people who all waited until the very last minute to turn in all our, you know, papers and exams when we had months and months and months and months to do any of the work that we ever had to do. So, you know, if we're going to do something like that with things that are inconsequential, like, you know, papers for college, certainly we're going to do that with the world as well. We are really good at last moment improvisation and really bad at methodical step-by-step planning. So I am optimistic. I wish we were a little more organized.
Il y avait un écrivain de science-fiction français, je crois que c'est Robert Merle, qui disait « L'humanité a la sale habitude de présenter des excuses aux cadavres. » Pour revenir aux morts, je reviens au soldat de la flotte fantôme. Et le fait que cette âme est fabriquée. Il y a donc, selon vous, une nature profonde innée à l'être humain. Le transfert d'esprit, par exemple, sous-entend-il que vous pensiez que nous ayons une sorte d'âme, ou bien que dans votre œuvre, cette toile totalement tributaire de son support biologique, finalement, je parle du cerveau, là, et de sa configuration.
I don't know that there is a soul in the classical sense of a duality of the mind and the body, where after we cease to exist as physical beings, we then move on to a higher plane of existence. I tend to be an agnostic of the sort that believes that when you're dead, you're dead. So in that sort of sense, no. Do I believe that the mind is kind of its own thing, and that in many ways it can be replicated or recorded or something like that? Yes, absolutely. To some extent, you know, quite honestly, every writer, everyone who writes, their soul survives through their work, because the things that they have said, the things that they have thought, the things that they have produced outlive their own life. That people will read books from people who have been dead for 100, 200, 2,000 years. And in that sort of very not great way, if you really wanted to live forever, you know, and believe that there was an eternal reward, that's going to be cold comfort. But for me, I think that's really interesting. I don't pretend that I am writing stuff that is going to be read 400, 500 years from now. But I think 100 years from now, people will still be looking at the books and still be seeing what my thoughts were on certain things. And I think that's just very, very interesting. Now, and I also do think that people think of the part of their consciousness that thinks beyond themselves, that thinks of their community, that thinks of their family, that thinks of people that they've never even met. That part of you is essentially your soul. It is the part of you that believes there is something greater than your own individual needs and desires and thoughts. The idea of planting a tree that you will never see bear fruit, as an example of that. That is an example of you exhibiting your soul. And I think it's real important that, you know, we honor that, and that we make clear that this is, in many ways, the best part of us, the part of us that plans ahead, the part that can see a world that doesn't exist now but could exist through our own actions. Science fiction writers create worlds all the time, dystopias, utopias, that imagine a world that could be, and sometimes they're cautionary, and sometimes they are encomium, sometimes they are, we could have this if we just tried, or this is what you will have if you don't. Every time we do that, science fiction writers and fantasy writers are exhibiting the fact that they have a soul, because they are thinking beyond just this moment to what could be and what we could achieve. So I think all of us have the capacity to have a soul, to think beyond ourselves, to exist beyond ourselves, to make a mark beyond ourselves. Whether or not we choose to do that is an individual decision.
Alors du coup, si vous écriviez un roman de science-fiction parlant de l'immortalité, sachant que la plupart du temps, tout ce que j'ai lu, que ce soit La Cité et les Astres d'Arthur C. Clarke, à Le Goût de l'immortalité de Catherine Dufour, par exemple, qui est sur ce festival, chaque fois la vision de l'humanité, où il y a aussi Eternity Incorporated de Granier de Cassagnac, chaque fois l'immortalité c'est mal. Chaque fois l'humain ne sait pas qu'en faire, en meurt, s'en sert pour détruire à côté. Est-ce qu'on ne pourrait pas envisager une immortalité heureuse? Qu'est-ce qu'on pourrait faire de l'immortalité?
My friend Michael Burns, who is I've known since we were about 11 years old, I asked him once, would you like to live forever? And he says, no, hell no, I get bored already. And I think essentially it's very difficult for us to as much as it's very difficult for us to imagine our own death and what happens with us after we're dead, at the same time, it's equally difficult to imagine what would happen if we could live forever. Do you do the same things that you've been doing for the last 30 or 40 years? Do you do something new? How do you continue to make the apprehension of the universe fresh and interesting and exciting and something that you want to be engaged in with on a day in and day out thing? I think that the ennui of immortality is a very real and very possible thing. I could be wrong. I'm willing to find out, you know, but quite honestly, I don't think that living forever would be a great idea for humans. I don't think that we are designed to continue to exist for 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 years. The person who lives that long would have to find something to do with their life that is meaningful. And quite a lot of what we do that is meaningful is tied into our own mortality. The idea that we have to do things now to make our mark now, to make an impression, to have an impact now because we won't be here later is one of the reasons that we do so many of the things that we do. Why do we care for our children? Because we want to see them live beyond our own years and be capable and not have to rely on us after we're gone. So I think one of the reasons that you have so many stories of immortality gone wrong or a miserable immortal is simply because we as human creatures can't conceive of living so long that we won't get bored, that we won't eventually, our brains won't dissolve into entropy. So it could happen. I mean, there could be a very cheerful person who lives forever, but my friend Michael Burns was right. I get bored now. There are lots of times where I'm just, what am I doing with myself? And I'm only, and I'm 49.
Si vous voulez, on s'en va.
No, we're fine now. This is interesting to me, but in a larger sense.
I was joking. Mais en tout cas, sur cette question, je vais vous faire la réponse de Terry Pratchett, qui était qu'il ne fallait pas sous-estimer la capacité de curiosité du singe que nous étions, et que la curiosité pouvait nous soutenir pendant quand même des millénaires. Je vais revenir à Frankenstein, puisque par le biais du mythe. Okay. Isaac Asimov disait plus ou moins que la science-fiction était massivement victime d'un certain complexe de Frankenstein. J'ai personnellement le sentiment que le Ghost Brigade, les brigades fantômes, constituent volontairement une réponse à la fois ironique et contradictoire. Parce que Prométhée réussit son coup dans ce roman, il me semble. Qu'est-ce que vous en pensez?
The people who are in the book and the Ghost Brigades have to create for themselves their own reasons for living, you know, their own reasons for doing what they do. They go through the same crises that all humans do. They just do it a lot faster and in adult bodies. So in that respect, I really do think the only difference between them and us is, the circumstances of their particular birth and their particular mission in life. But they do, sooner or later, you have to take responsibility for yourself. You have to be your own person. You have to decide what is it that you are doing that makes sense for you to do, even if it means sacrificing your own selfhood for a larger community or for somebody else. Certainly in the case of the Ghost Brigades, we have a situation where the protagonist knows that his time is limited, his time is short, but within that time, he can do certain things that will resonate beyond his own life and will be the benefit of other people. And it's his crisis, as it were, is to decide to do those things as opposed to anything else. So, yeah, I mean, he is the captain of his own fate. He is the person who makes the decision. He is, you know, if the figurative Prometheus deciding to hand over the fire, even though there is the penalty from the gods, sort of thing. Absolutely. But again, that is the crisis of every human. Prometheus was a Titan or a demigod, but he was fundamentally human because he was saying, "Look at these cold, starving people. I can solve this problem. There will be consequences for me solving this problem for them, but the benefit to them will be immeasurable." And so he made that decision. He made that sacrifice. And the real question is, does Prometheus, as he's having his liver torn apart by the eagle, does he ever regret what he's done? And there's nothing in the mythology that suggests that he would do anything other than it is what that he did, which is something that I don't actually see addressed all that often, frankly.
En fait, dans la mythologie, tout suggère qu'il ferait exactement la même chose en sachant les millénaires de souffrance qu'il aurait derrière. Et en ignorant que Héraclès le délivrerait à la fin des fins. Cela étant, on va changer de paradigme, là. Et pour passer à un autre roman de vous qui m'a particulièrement touchée également, c'est Les Enfermés. Vous y décrivez les survivants d'une pandémie à jamais prisonniers de leur corps, empêchés mais capables d'user de robots, les 6P, pour interagir avec le monde. Alors ces robots ont un différent degré de sensibilité par rapport à l'extérieur. Ils permettent aux add-on, on les appelle comme ça, de, par exemple, oublier leur souffrance, la souffrance de leur propre corps physique qui est enfermé dans dans un lit médicalisé particulièrement sophistiqué. Et de même que les soldats du cycle du vieil homme et la guerre, ils possèdent des améliorations corporelles. De même que les soldats du cycle du vieil homme et la guerre possèdent des améliorations corporelles assez fabuleuses. Entre la réparation des dommages dans les enfermés et l'optimisation, voire la transformation des capacités humaines dans les brigades fantômes. Est-ce que vous voyez ces histoires dans une perspective transhumaniste?
Oh, certainly they're transhumanist. I mean, the idea is that they are, in the Ghost Brigades, they have these super improved bodies that are far beyond the capability of an average human body. In Locken, the bodies are tuned to be similar to human capabilities, but in fact, the humans that are piloting these bodies are trapped from their physical bodies. And so in many ways, and the way that they are perceived by others, even though others know that there is a human inside that machine, they still see the machine first. So in many ways, what you are seeing is people apprehending both the Special Defense Forces and the Haydens, who are walking around in the Threeps, the android bodies, as something fundamentally other than human. And that will have repercussions for who they are and how they respond. I mean, in many ways, our bodies are ourselves. There is a mind-body duality, quite literally in the case of Locken, but the perception is always based on the body. Other people's perception of you will always be based on what you present to them. And if you present a robot form, then in many ways they're going to think of you as an other. So yes, there is definitely some transhumanism there. But fundamentally, even though the Haydens present in android bodies, even though the Special Defense Forces are in superhuman bodies, their minds are still fundamentally human, and they still have the same problems that other humans do. They have the issue of where I belong, how am I interacting with people, how do I find friendship, love, intimacy, how do I deal with all the day-to-day living things that everyone has to deal with. They are transhuman, but they are also still human. There is a connecting tissue, quite literally, in the brain, that keeps them both as human and as something other than human. And it's an interesting conflict. You know, it's one of those things that you... It's always fun for writers to think about superhuman beings and or improved beings or androids or any of those sorts of things. But if you're not thinking about the consequences of the body, if you're not thinking about the consequences of the body on the mind, on the person, on the development of the self, then you aren't doing your job as a writer. You are not looking at the consequences. And to bring it back to Frankenstein, you know, one of the things that Victor Frankenstein did not do is he did not look at the consequences of reanimating that flesh. He did not think of the person. He only thought of the body, and much to his regret and much to the regret of the monster.
Tout à fait. Il ne se rend pas compte qu'on est toujours et à jamais responsable de ce qu'on a apprivoisé. Alors, a fortiori, qu'on s'est créé. Du coup, j'ai envie de poser une autre question un peu piège. Vous avez écrit quelque part que lorsque vous avez décidé... vous avez écrit plein de choses qu'on voit là actuellement qui défilent sur les écrans. Que vous avez tiré votre carrière d'écrivain de science-fiction à pile ou face avec votre carrière d'écrivain de polar, et que c'est la science-fiction qui a gagné. Est-ce que Les Enfermés, c'est pas une tentative de mettre la pièce sur la tranche et de réunir le John Scalzi qui aurait pu être et le John Scalzi qui y est?
Right. Well, what we're talking about here is when I decided that I wanted to write a novel in my late 20s. I was about to go to my 10th high school reunion, and I knew they would ask me if I had written a novel yet. And so I decided to write one, and I loved crime fiction and I loved science fiction equally, so I flipped a coin to decide which one I would write. And it landed on Heads, which meant that I would write science fiction. And I often think about what would happen if I had landed on Tails and I had been a mystery writer. Things would have been very, very different for me. The nice thing about science fiction is that you can write in science fiction so many different things. You can write romance, you can, you know, you can write comedy, you can write a mystery, you can write a thriller, you can do all of these things as long as it does the metaphors of science fiction that people understand. So for me, it wasn't a conscious attempt to, you know, meld those two things together, but it was the realization that science fiction is an expansive field, and that there's so much that could be done in the field if you just decide to do it. And I'm certainly not the first person to have that epiphany. I mean, there have been people who've been writing social commentary in science fiction for as long as we've had science fiction. I mean, is not Frankenstein social commentary about the relationship of God and man? So as far as it goes, I'm not making any new revelations there. I was just happy that I got to write a murder mystery that included android bodies.
De toute façon, Isaac Asimov en a aussi écrit des thrillers, parce que les cavernes d'acier, c'est la même chose. Alors, vous avez été brièvement l'élève de Saul Bellow, très brièvement. Non.
Yes.
Yeah. Votre tendance à l'humour lui doit-elle quelque chose, parce que c'était un écrivain et un homme très drôle? I'm sorry.
Okay.
Ou plutôt, vous l'avez choisi parce qu'il était comme ça, ou bien votre rencontre fut totalement fortuite? Et alors, la vraie question, elle est là. L'ordre de la politesse, est-ce que votre humour, c'est la politesse du désespoir, l'enrobage sucré qui fait passer la pilule, ou tout simplement de la provocation?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on what I'm writing and what my point is when I was writing it. Saul Bellow was my thesis advisor at the University of Chicago very briefly. He and I had met basically because I thought that he would be a good thesis advisor for what I wanted to do. I presented it to him, and his first assignment was go read Stendhal, Scarlet and the Black, and then write a report on what you think about that. And while I was doing that, yeah, no pressure there. But certainly that was kind of an interesting thing to have happen. The humor does not necessarily come from Bello directly, although of course I am an admirer of his writing, obviously. The humor comes from all sorts of places and from all sorts of people. It comes from the journalism of people like Molly Ivins and Mike Royko, who would, you know, on a daily basis write about columns about the world that they lived in. It comes from the Algonquin Roundtable people of Dorothy Parker and Robert Benchley and James Thurber. And their wry observations that were also couched in, you know, sadness in many ways. It comes from film, people like Ben Hecht or Elaine May or Larry Gelbart and William Goldman, where their dialogue is back and forth and very snappy. It comes from a lot of places. One of the things that I truly believe as a science fiction writer and as a writer in general is that you don't limit yourself. You don't limit yourself to influences. You don't limit yourself to the people who can teach you, who can show you how to do things. You don't reject it simply because you don't think it is high-toned enough. One of the funniest writers in the 20th century is unheralded in most circles. It's Michael Maltese. He is the fellow who wrote so many of the Chuck Jones Warner Brothers cartoons, so many of the Bugs Bunny ones, the ones, What's Opera Doc, the Roadrunner cartoons with the physical humor, Feed the Kitty. So many of these things are beautiful, you know, tiny pieces of comedy, and they're just brilliant, and yet his name is unrecognized as one of the geniuses of comedy, which I think is just a sin, you know, but he's another person who's, you know, his comic timing shows up in my writing, or at least I hope it does. So it comes from everywhere, and you learn from everyone, you steal from everyone, you give credit to everyone, because otherwise what is the point, so that other people can follow and find out why these people are important to you. But certainly Saul Bellow is important in my development as a writer, but he is one of many.
Les procédés scénaristiques, ça fait partie de votre humour, il me semble. Et notamment, alors il faut que j'avoue au public que mon grand coup de cœur pour l'œuvre de John Scalzi, c'est The Ghost Brigade, au cas où vous ne l'auriez pas compris. Mais j'aimais également toute l'œuvre de John Scalzi. Mais dans The Ghost Brigade, au tout début, le premier chapitre, c'est vraiment un piège, ce premier chapitre des Ghost Brigade. Et ça m'a rappelé une nouvelle qui s'appelait La Sentinelle, où un soldat est en train de parler du dernier moment de la guerre, où il va se dresser devant son ennemi, qui est un envahisseur alien. Et à la toute fin, on se rend compte que l'envahisseur alien, c'est un être humain, en fait. Vous pensez à ça ?
Not that story in particular, but certainly the idea of the reversal, the idea that you would create a character that people would be concerned about, be sympathetic to, would be worried about, that they would see themselves in, and then after a certain point realize that person that they have invested so much time and energy and concern into was in fact completely unlike them at all. Was certainly something that I was very interested in doing. One of the things that I do in a lot of my novels, and Ghost Brigades is kind of the first time that I did it, is I do what I call the James Bond opening, where you have an opening sequence that is not necessarily related to the rest of the arc of the story, but which sets the scene, offers some exposition, some context and understanding, and is exciting and punchy so that the next couple of chapters that you have, you can do some world building, and people will follow you through that to get to the next big crest of action. And that was one of the reasons that I did that. But the other thing was, yes, as a writer, I thought it would be fun to say to the readers, you are invested in this person, but this person is not who you think they are. Surprise, you know. So yeah, absolutely, that was intentional.
C'était très réussi.
Thank
Alors,
you.
Il nous reste une minute, peut-être deux, pour une question du public. Alors, si vous avez quelque chose à demander à John Scalzi, c'est maintenant ou taisez-vous à jamais.
I didn't get a translation, so I don't know what you would have.
Nobody?
Oh, yes, raise your hand if you have a question that you want to ask me. And do it in the form of a question, please, because we don't have a lot of time. We want to make sure that we get as many questions as possible.
Trivial aussi. Pourquoi vous voulez tuer les Ewoks et les Red Skirts?
I don't want to kill the Ewoks. My characters want to kill the Ewoks. No, I think in the Ghost Brigades we had the characters go through many classics of science fiction, and one of the things that they all decided is that they didn't like the Ewoks. I think the idea was there that the Ewoks were so clearly meant to be cuddly plush toys for merchandising rather than integral to the plot that they're kind of offensive that way. That said, I love the Porgs from The Last Jedi, so I've succumbed to the cuteness factor. So I'm my own, I'm a hypocrite, is basically what I'm saying. Next question.
Non, pas de question suivante. Je vous remercie.
Oh, no.
C'était vraiment très agréable.
Thank you so much, everyone.